Loyal and prosperous ones are the ones who are determined, resolute, and strong-willed. They renew their faith every morning and evening and utilize their time with acts which please God and His noble messenger. With purity of intention, they always seek God's pleasure and approval in the thoughts, acts, and interactions. Although many desire to get high status and fame in society, they only follow the content of God because they know certainly that those who do not increase in dedication to worship of God as they grow older are really unfortunate, for it is a real loss at a time when making a tremendous profit. So the beautiful viewpoint of Imam Khomeini, Rahmatullah, is that even at the moment of the materialism, the world of materialistic point of views, you still have the power as a human being, have the power to change it to a spiritual form of connection with Allah Almighty. So don't lose this opportunity. Life is shorter than what you think.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
Salam. I'm a nature enthusiast and traveler. In Close Up Iran, I introduce you to the wonders and beauties of my country, Iran. Stay with me. It is said King Nasiruddin Shah Qajar stayed 3 days in Semnan on his way to Mashhad. There was a building at the time that had 12 different towers and a southern gate, but no gates on the north side. During his short stay in Semnan, Nasiruddin Shah ordered the ruler of the city to build the northern gate for the Arg or the citadel. and it means I'm going to Semnan province today. The Semnan Arc Gate is located in Semnan Province, north-central Iran. This gate is one of Semnan's most famous attractions that has become a symbol of this city and has spectacular engravings and illustrations. Built during the Qajar dynasty, this structure is above 7 meters high. Its decoration is so beautiful that it catches everyone's attention. This gate is the only remain of the old Arch of Semnan, and its glory shows the old Arch well. The complex used to consist of buildings such as a telegraph room, a water cistern, a bathroom, and so on. This gate has been registered in Iran's National Heritage List. Okay, right now I'm across from the famous gate of Semnan, the Semnan Arch Gate. Wow, it's unique. Where on earth can you find such a beautiful gate? It's interesting to note that Arch used to be an administrative center in the past, and this gate is just a small part of the old Arch of Semnan, which no longer exists. Let me take a closer look at this magnificent gate. Wow, it's very tall. And it has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yes, it has 6 minarets, which are built symmetrically. Oh, look. I think that is the most prominent feature of the portal. It depicts the historical story of Rostam and White Demon on 7 color tiles. Other tile decorations include the illustrations of Qajarid soldiers. And on the walls, there are tile work inscriptions written in the beautiful Nastaliq style of calligraphy. Astonishing! Let me check the southern part of the gate. In the southern part, there are 2 rooms which are built symmetrically, which are overlooking 2 Ivans. There are 2 small corridors along with the main entrance that used to be a place for entering and exiting. Although the northern part of the gate is much more distinguished than the southern gate, overall, this structure is a very, very special gate I've ever seen in whole of my life. And let me add one thing. The doors. They're made of thick wood, which are decorated with beautiful door studs. And be careful. Just like the past, the door will be closed after the sunset.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The United States has launched a new wave of attacks in Yemen. A fresh missile salvo was fired from U.S. Navy ships stationed in the Red Sea and targeted sites that were allegedly prepared to launch attacks. Over a dozen locations were said to have been hit in the strikes. The Yemeni Sabah News Agency reported that the aerial assault hit the provinces of Hodeidah, Taiz, Damar, Al-Baida, and Sada. The aggression was accompanied by the presence of surveillance aircraft over the western part of Yemen.
This aggression will not change anything in the stance of our people and its spiritual obligation in supporting the Palestinian people and the residents of Gaza, as well as the continuous targeting of ships linked to Israel. And this is clear in our continuous operations.
Yemeni armed forces have said that they will not hesitate to target all sources of threat in the Arabian and Red Seas within the country's legitimate right of self-defense. They've also warned that any aggression against Yemen by the U.S. or the U.K. will not go unanswered and unpunished. The Washington designated Ansarullah movement as a terrorist organization. The Ansarullah resistance movement has described the U.S. move to redesignate the movement as a terrorist organization as, quote, a badge of honor.
Designation of the United States here in Yemen, they don't care about that, but they are honored to have that relisting as a terrorist organization because we know, and as Sayyid Abdulmalik have said, United States is just the face of the crime. United States is one of the countries that have destroyed, have destruction wherever they go. So we are honored to be designated as terrorist because, as always they say, one man terrorist is another man freedom fighter.
Ansarullah spokesman Mohammed Abdel Salam added that the move also proves the impact of Yemen's anti-Israeli operations in the Red Sea. As part of their support for Palestinians, the Yemeni armed forces and Ansarullah popular resistance movement have, over the past month, targeted several ships owned by the Israeli regime or bound for ports in the occupied territories in the strategic Red Sea after multiple warnings. Earlier in January, the U.S., along with the U.K., attacked Yemen in a theatrical show of support for the Israeli regime.
The issue that America and Britain have joined the war directly and that we are now in direct confrontation with the Americans, British and Israelis does not scare us at all. The aggression towards our country and our people will enhance the development of our military capabilities.
This was a brutal aggression, a violation of our sovereignty. After 10 years of war on the Yemeni people, a siege on land, air, and sea, and to add to that, they are targeting us with a new aggression. This is a new stage of the conflict. What does this reflect? It reflects a violation of sovereignty, further injustice towards people.
Washington and London have supplied money, weapons, and diplomatic cover for the Zionist occupation of Palestine. They are actively promoting genocide, ethnic cleansing, racism, apartheid, cruel, dehumanization, and extreme barbarism in occupied Palestine.
it's obvious who is on the side of genocide: Britain, France, Canada, the Netherlands, and others, and Germany, especially. And on the side of right, on the side of morality, is world public opinion, the Yemeni government.
The Western hegemonic powers and their Zionist ally have faced a disgraceful defeat in Gaza in the face of the resilience and steadfastness of Hamas and other Palestinian resistance groups. Yemeni military has single-handedly posed the biggest threat to the economic functioning of the Israeli occupation by forcing it out of the Red Sea and further promising to stop the movement of ships to the occupied territories if their aggression against Gaza continues. In response to the Yemeni military's actions, the U.S. formed a so-called multinational coalition in the Red Sea under the guise of protecting international trade, which in reality was an attempt to protect the status quo in regional waters that have traditionally been in the service of Western interests. Yemeni military's efforts have been noted for being highly sophisticated and precise.
The Yemeni attacks have been extraordinarily effective, first of all. Shipping costs are rising, have risen. Insurance for ships is going up. And this will only get worse. So Israel is taking a pretty significant economic hit.
Major shipping companies have had to halt operations in the Red Sea and to take new, longer routes. And the U.S. has been scrambling to pressure the Saudis to avoid a peace deal with Yemen. Yemen's retaliatory strikes has also halted all commercial activities in the port of Eilat in the occupied territories. Yemen has, in fact, set a new equation with global consequences and has pushed the U.S. from a position of dominance to one of defense, having to react and succumb to the resistance demands. The International Court of Justice in The Hague has held its hearing to consider its provisional measures on a lawsuit filed by South Africa against the Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip. The case sets a precedent as the first at the ICJ relating to the siege on the Gaza Strip, where thousands of people have been killed since October 7. Pretoria accuses Israel of committing genocide in contravention of the 1948 UN Genocide Convention, which both South Africa and the regime are party to. South Africa alleges that the killing of civilians in large numbers, especially children, the expulsion and displacement of Palestinians en masse, and the destruction of their homes, then citing statements by several Israeli officials portraying Palestinians as subhumans.
Israel's conduct violates Articles 2A, 2B, 2C, and 2D of the Convention. The first genocidal act committed by Israel is the mass killing of Palestinians in Gaza, in violation of Article 2A of the Genocide Convention.
It's an application that's split into two sections. One is the intent to commit genocide, and the second bit deals here with the actual acts of genocide. And many of international legal scholars and others have indicated that it's very difficult for Israel to effectively answer to these cases without having to concede that their actions are indeed in violation of the Geneva Conventions.
To be collectively punished, all constitute genocide and show proof of intent. Evidence submitted by South Africa says acts and omissions by Israel are genocidal in character because they are intended to bring about the destruction of a substantial part of the Palestinian national, racial, and ethnic group. This refers both to what Israel is actively doing, such as carrying out airstrikes, and what it is failing to do, such as preventing harm to civilians.
Gaza, which is one of the most densely populated places in the world, is home to approximately 2.3 million Palestinians, almost half of them children. For the past 96 days, Israel has subjected Gaza to what has been described as one of the heaviest conventional bombing campaigns in the history of modern warfare. Palestinians in Gaza are being killed by Israeli weaponry and bombs from air, land, and sea.
The suit also lists the blockade on food and the destruction of essential health services for pregnant women and babies as measures by Tel Aviv intended to bring about their destruction as a GRIB, the Organization of Islamic Countries, the Arab League, Iran, Bolivia, Colombia, and Brazil, and a number of other countries have also supported South Africa's decision to file the case against Israel. Iran has urged international bodies and agencies, including the UN Security Council, to adopt immediate and practical steps aimed at complete cessation of Israeli military strikes in Gaza.
For people of my age, we were brought up in the struggle against apartheid in South Africa, and to see them leading the charge against Israel was really poignant. So there's a lot riding on this. Obviously, the lives and well-being of people in Gaza, first and foremost, but international law itself is on trial here, and I think the court has to know that.
The separate case is continuing at the International Criminal Court. Both courts are located in The Hague, Netherlands. While the purpose of the ICJ is to resolve conflicts between political regimes, the ICC prosecutes individuals for committing crimes.
This could be a turning point. This could be a moment where the world rises up in one voice and says in very emphatic term that is supposed to embody justice and equality and the rule of law, that these actions by Israel amounts to genocide, torture, and something that we have not witnessed, I think, really in the history of mankind.
Under international law, genocide is defined as committing one or more acts with the intention to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group.
There is also the clear pattern of conduct, the targeting of family homes and civilian infrastructure, laying waste to vast areas of Gaza, and the bombing, shelling, and sniping of men, women, and children where they stand, the destruction of the health infrastructure, and lack of access to humanitarian assistance.
The gruesome scenes of death and destruction in Gaza are a reminder that for Israel, violence is not incidental, accidental, or coincidental. It is part and parcel of its colonial policies. For decades, Israel has used disproportionate force and has carried out countless massacres against Palestinian civilians as a form of revenge and punishment. Most of Gaza's 2.3 million people have also been displaced since October 7, with aid agencies warning of famine risk amid mounting hunger. The 365 square kilometer territory.
Israel's conduct has been deliberately calculated to cause widespread hunger, dehydration, and starvation. Israel's campaign has pushed Gazans to the brink of famine. An unprecedented 93% of the population in Gaza is facing crisis levels of hunger, but removing the ability to distribute it through constant
has already been under an Israeli blockade since 2007. Recent UN General Assembly votes show that most of the international community is appalled by Israel's brutalization of Gaza, yet appears unable to act. Throughout the past decades, Israel has controlled the Palestinian territories in part to colonize them through hundreds of illegal settlements on stolen Palestinian lands, in part to hold their population hostage until their leaders accept its political dictates. The Israeli oppression of Palestinians had already witnessed a sharp rise under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's extremist coalition cabinet, which is composed of far-right Zionist parties that oppose Palestinian statehood and support the expansion of settlements in the occupied lands. Hunger has become the most pressing of the myriad problems facing hundreds of thousands of displaced Gaza Palestinians, with aid trucks able to bring in only a small fraction of what is needed, and distribution uneven due to the chaos of the war. The Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, a Geneva-based rights group, has found that 71% of people in the Gaza Strip suffer from extreme hunger due to Israel's devastating war on the Palestinian territory and the regime's method of using starvation as a weapon. The group released the figure after it conducted an analytical study of a sample of 1,200 people in Gaza. According to the study's findings, 98% of respondents said that they eat insufficient amounts of food, while 64% of the participants admitted to eating grass, immature food, and expired materials to satiate their hunger.
All 2.2 million people are hungry, meaning that they are in crisis or worse food security situation.
More than 130,000 of Gaza's most vulnerable children, that is newborns up to 2 years of age, are not receiving the critical life-saving breastfeeding or age-appropriate complementary feeding that they absolutely require. So that's our scenario. Without sufficient safe water, food and sanitation that only a humanitarian ceasefire would bring, child deaths due to disease could well surpass those already killed in bombardments.
The study found that the rate of access to water in the Gaza Strip, including drinking, bathing and cleaning water, is 1.5 liters per person per day. This is 15 liters less than the minimum amount of water required for survival at the level required by international standards. Additionally, the study examined the effects of malnutrition and a lack of access to clean drinking water. 66% of the study sample reported having experienced diarrhea, skin rashes, or intestinal diseases in the past month. Even in Rafah, which has a crossing to Egypt through which aid trucks enter, the dearth of food and clean water is so severe, it is causing people to get ill.
The contaminated water is another issue, as the water is not 100% clean, so children and adults suffer from intestinal problems such as vomiting and diarrhea. So I ran out of antidiarrheal medications, Flagyl medicines, which is an intestinal disinfectant, and Silabrin, which is antibiotics for intestinal infections. There's a significant loss of these drugs.
Since the start of its genocide in Gaza, Israel has imposed a comprehensive blockade on the Strip and prevented supplies of food, water, fuel, and other humanitarian necessities from reaching the more than 2.3 million residents of the Strip. Israel's use of starvation as a weapon has intensified since October 7 and has included cutting off all food supplies to Gazans, as well as bombing and destroying the Strip's bakeries, factories, food stores.
We were compelled to come here as there are no bakeries available. The people here who are our friends are baking bread to aid the community. Procuring flour is challenging for us, as a 20-kilogram bag costs around 300 to 400 shekels, which is a substantial amount.
About 577,000, meaning more than 500,000 people, are already in catastrophic levels of hunger, meaning they're essentially starving. That is like one in every four people.
Speeches and statements from Israeli officials promoting a campaign to deliberately block access to necessary resources for the Gaza population as a strategy indicate that Israel has not made these intentions a secret. The Israeli blockade, on top of the genocidal aggression, has plunged Gaza into humanitarian catastrophe, where lack of access to sanitation and safe water has increased the prevalence of waterborne diseases. The Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court says that intentionally starving civilians by, quote, depriving them of objects indispensable to their survival, including willfully impeding relief supplies, is a war crime.
The people in the hospitals, yes, they need everything. They need medical supplies, but what they ask for first is food and water, the very basics. They do not have them. One of my colleagues described people lying on the floor in severe pain, in agony, but they weren't asking for pain relief, they were asking for water.
The plight of Gaza's 2.3 million people has become desperate amid the war. Around 80% of Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip have been displaced by the violence, while efforts to get aid into the territory have struggled. Alarmed humanitarian organizations have been calling for a ceasefire and denouncing the shocking cost of the catastrophic war, which amounts to a collective punishment of the civilian population of Gaza.
We are homeless. We can't go back to our houses. I want to see my children. I want to go back to my husband and to my house. It's unfair. It's so unfair.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, you might be a bad person if you don't like amassing wealth. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is an honor to be here at your service, dear friends. We're talking about an Islamic lifestyle. And of course, wealth is an integral part of any lifestyle, but it is most importantly an integral part of an Islamic lifestyle. Now, we're talking about these things over multiple programs because wealth and economic and financial independence is something which is very, very important, and it has been spoken about a lot in the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhimus salam, and even in the Holy Quran. So this is something which is very important to talk about. Now, we're talking about how you might be a bad person if you don't like amassing wealth. Normally, what people think and what the perception of people is that amassing wealth is something which is not good. And so you're a bad person if you amass wealth. Now, to a certain extent, this is true. When we start to amass wealth greedily, unjustly, in haram and unlawful and prohibited manner, or if we start to amass wealth and hoard that wealth, keep that wealth in our pockets, then yes, these are all the traits and characteristics of a un-Islamic lifestyle, right? So if you amass wealth and you are, you know, committing sin with this wealth, or you are greedily keeping that wealth in your pocket, or you are amassing that wealth in unlawful and haram and prohibited ways, you know, or you are amassing wealth and you are of no help to anyone, then in this instance, this amassing of wealth is a un-Islamic act and should be refrained from. But what did we say is our title, and what is the perception or the angle that we're taking? We're taking this angle that if you don't amass wealth, you might be a bad person. So what kind of wealth being amassed are we talking about? So I guess let's reverse the equation so that it's not so confusing anymore. And that is that, you know, perhaps amassing wealth does qualify you to be a good person. Now, in this segment, before we conclude this segment, we talked about how amassing wealth will result in an individual being a bad person when it comes to Islamic lifestyle and the rules and regulations and commandments of the Almighty Allah, which, of course, we listed twice. In the next segment, you know, we're going to talk about how amassing wealth can result in us being good people. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about how if you don't amass wealth, you might be a bad person. Now, because it was kind of a confusing equation and, you know, we might not really understand what is being said and we have to repeat it a couple of times, what we reversed the equation and we said that, you know, you in order to be a good person, you might have to amass wealth, meaning if you amass wealth, you might be a good person. So what are we saying here? Now, if you amass wealth, what are you doing with that wealth, right? So going, working hard, making ends meet, earning an income, you know, this is all that is recommended and highly recommended, right? Poverty is, voluntary poverty is highly reprimanded. So it is highly encouraged to make ends meet, and not only that, to earn as much wealth as you can. Now, here is what is the caveat. Here is what is the important part. And we find that Imam Ja'far Sadiq alayhi salam, the sixth divinely appointed Imam, he says in a tradition that there is no good in anyone who does not like amassing wealth. Again, I'm going to repeat because this is very important. There is no good in anyone who does not like amassing wealth in lawful manners. Why? Because I don't want to say the why because it'll confuse us. I'm just going to explain the why. Imam Ja'far Sadiq alayhi salam is saying that you should amass wealth. You should work hard and collect wealth. But what is important is what you do with that wealth. And so the sixth divinely appointed Imam, he says that with that wealth, if you safeguard your prestige, your honor, the honor of your family, the honor of your friends, or with that wealth, you pay off your debts, you owe people money, you need to pay them back. Or if you maintain family ties, meaning you help your family members, you help your friends, you know, you give them gifts or you give them loans, right? Or for example, you help the poor or you manage your family's affairs, you manage your own affairs, right? You bring honor to Islam. When you do all of these things, and perhaps even there's many, many more good deeds that you can do with this wealth that you have amassed. In this sense, amassing wealth will turn you into a righteous and pious person. So it is what you do with that wealth which will either make you a good person or a bad person. The criteria is Islam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Economic Divide.
As the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war in Gaza has passed 100 days, the Israeli regime is trying hard to portray an image of success in the battlefield, but it has failed to do so. When it comes to the economy itself, it's also suffering due to the genocidal war. But it is becoming clear that a shortage of manpower is one of the toughest challenges that it is facing, amongst others, since with employees, or without them, I should say, how can it have an economy? Hello, welcome to Economic Divide. These are some of the highlights that we'll be looking at. The settler violence when it comes to the occupied West Bank economy is a big problem. This has impacted the economy there, canceled work permits on top of that, and of course the intensified restrictions, making things very hard. Also, the Palestinian Authority tax revenues again being withheld by Israel. For example, last month, almost $140 million. As a result, salaries have not been paid. Then, moving on to another highlight of the economy, we focused on Israel in terms of the multifaceted crisis that Israel's economy is facing. One of them is lack of investment, or I should say low consumer confidence, which then you have a lack of investment. These are all plaguing the economy and dragging it down.
Israel's genocide on the people of Palestine in Gaza and the occupied West Bank has cost thousands of lives. The onslaught has also plunged the territories into an economic crisis. Since October 7, Israel has stepped up military raids in the West Bank, and violence by Israeli settlers has increased sharply. Escalating violence by the Israeli military and settlers, intensified restrictions on mobility, tens of thousands of canceled work permits, and the withholding of tax revenues from the Palestinian Authority are combining to tip the territory into a humanitarian crisis. With hundreds of thousands losing their jobs, Palestinian families are experiencing poverty in addition to an overall drop in the quality of life amidst an absence of safety. The International Labor Organization estimates that Israel's revocation of work permits for Palestinians has eliminated around 208,000 jobs, about 24% of all employment in the occupied West Bank. Access restrictions to Israel's labor market has cost the Palestinian economy losses at around $500 million since October the 7th, with the unemployment rate to have reached a record 52%. For tens of thousands of government employees, the situation is also bleak.
Time now to find out what has been posted online on this topic. First, we take a look at the website that stated, as the Gaza war, we call it an onslaught, dominates, Israeli actions tip the West Bank into an economic and security crisis. It said, you don't know what new checkpoints will be set up and which group of settlers you will be attacked by. Next up, a viewer comment called St. Thomas said that tourism has come to a virtual standstill and spending has jumped. The hit to tech companies has shaken confidence in a sector that has become a key driver of Israel's economy. The call-up of 350,000 Army reservists disrupted operations at many companies. Many customer orders were put on hold or canceled outright. As the crisis in Gaza worsens, so does the economic situation in the West Bank, as Israel withholds $150 million a month to the PA. That's the Palestinian Authority. That means the PA is unable to pay its security forces at a time when the West Bank is boiling. And finally, another viewer comments by the name of IB Nomer. There's nothing, no Israeli tourists, no non-Israeli tourists, no weddings, no henna celebrations before the weddings, no housewarmings. Ouch, that hurts. Let me introduce our guest for the first section of the Q&A. First up, we have David Hungerford. David Hungerford is an author and economist. David Hungerford, welcome to Economic Divide. All eyes are on the humanitarian situation in Gaza. That's a given. 100 days is past even that. This genocide is continuing. But at the same time, you have an economic crisis unfolding. You're looking at the way that funds are evaporating. You don't have a budget that can keep up with the war costs. How severely has this genocide or war impacted West Bank's economy, both for the Israel and the Palestinians, for that matter?
Well, we're talking about, I think, here primarily about cross-border workers. That is to say, workers who live in the West Bank and commute to work in Israel. So that has been interrupted, and that's quite a large economic volume, particularly locally, around $5.5 billion USD per year. So that's being badly disrupted, and certainly it's going to be contributory, over the longer run to Israel's difficulties in this situation.
All right, thank you for that. Joe Quinn joins us now. Joe Quinn is an editor at SOT.net. Joe Quinn, welcome to Economic Divide. Our guests there talked about the worker crisis. Here we have another crisis that's been ongoing for quite some time, but it has increased, and that's these vicious settlers who are attacking Palestinians. At the same time, the restrictions on mobility has increased multifold, tens of thousands of canceled work permits, which goes to the Palestinian workers, and the withholding of tax revenues from the Palestinian Authority. They're all contributing to this economic crisis. But all of these problems are originating from Israel. Why is Israel shooting itself in the foot this way?
Well, yeah, pretty much every problem that the Palestinians have originates with Israel. Of course, when a state like Israel, with the backing of the West, initiates a kind of that kind of genocidal policy against an entire people, well, yeah, they're doing it across the board. They're not just bombing. They're trying to create intolerable living conditions intolerable living conditions for the people of Gaza through bombing them and evicting them from their homes. But they're also focusing very much on the West Bank, and like I said, they've cut off all of the vast majority of jobs that Palestinians were doing in Israel. They have been cut off. And they also have been retaining funds, the Palestinian Authority's tax revenue that Israel has long had control over and sometimes restricts or sometimes allows them. They basically cut that off from the beginning of October 7th. They cut off that tax revenue. So the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank is having a lot of trouble actually functioning as a kind of government for the Palestinian people in the West Bank. And that on top of a significant reduction in jobs is creating, a serious economic crisis. But it's all by design, by Israel. It's on purpose. It's part of a plan, obviously.
Time now for the infamous section of the program. Our first item is something we covered in the last week, but there's an update to it in a way. First, the topic itself is the Israeli troop withdrawal from the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war. Now, Israel has said that it's going to pull several brigades from the Gaza Strip, the northern part, to be exact. We heard that piece of news before. We covered it here at Economic Divide last week. But this is where it gets interesting. The military has said a growing toll on the Israeli economy after nearly 3 months of wartime mobilization with little end in sight to the fighting. Okay, aside from that, the fact that it's a growing toll on the Israeli economy, that speaks volumes, because many are saying there's a shortage of manpower that's affecting the economy. But it's a shortage of people contributing to the economy, like the reservists, which is said to be around 300,000, give or take, is the problem with the economy. Interesting point there. All right, move up Israel's economic crisis, as if we haven't covered that in this program. This particular entry said how the war in Gaza is taking a toll on the economy there. And it said that the Israeli military is sending these soldiers home from Gaza. And again, this is emphasizing what I just said before, in order to re-energize the economy, which faces a massive labor shortage because of the war. So here you have it. You have the two different angles when it comes to this. Is it a combination of both, or is it the fact that there's a shortage of people contributing to the economy? I'll leave the answer to that question up to you. Another aspect of the war, the occupied West Bank, is being affected by this U.S.-Israeli onslaught. Israel's wartime curbs have ravaged the West Bank economy, from stores to startups, restrictions on movement, for example, and also cuts to the Palestinian Authority. Let's not forget that Palestinian Authority has to pay their staff. They're not getting the money for it. That's a repeated move by the Israeli regime. And because of that cash shortage, it has put businesses at risk. Now, in terms of the way that we looked at this, we also wanted to add this piece of information. Since the onslaught began, Israel has almost entirely stopped allowing Palestinians from the occupied West Bank to enter Israel for work. So obviously that impacts the economy of the West Bank. Next up, another impact of the Israeli onslaught, and that's on the prices of energy. The World Bank warning of energy prices price surge if the Mideast war, which we call West Asia, spreads. And it's a new economic report which predicted a year of weak growth and said that the world faced a decade of wasted opportunity. Well, based on that, we figured we need to give our 2 cents, as they say here. And our analysis is the converging crises in recent years have put the world economy on track for the weakest half decade in 30 years, okay, based on the research we did. Without a major course correction, the 2020s will go down as a decade of wasted opportunity.
Listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Israel's labor shortage has created a big headache for the economy. It's not easy to fix a manpower shortage, like a shortage, for example, of cash. Although Israel has brought in foreign workers, unfortunately for them, the problem still persists. Let's take a look at some of the costs that are involved. Well, the costs attributed to the absence of workers and a decline in productivity due to the complete closure, for example, of schools or educational institutions, that cost is quite high. We're looking at a cost of roughly about $325 million. Now, consider that based on what I just mentioned, $325 million, okay? Let's take a look now at the other aspect of this where there's costs involved. Here is the absence of work. The previous one was workers. This is the absence of work. 144,000 evacuated residents from war-affected areas. The total cost that is incurred because of that is $154 million, all right? And then finally, we want to take a look at the cost that results in this case in points. Again, we're looking at the cost cumulatively. This would be based on the reservist recruitment. We have mentioned this quite a bit. But we're looking at, this is an updated number, of about 360,000 Israeli reserve soldiers. The cost that is incurred on that is roughly the figure that we have here, $130 million. That's the total tally there. Now, what we want to do, so you can get an idea before we move on to our guest, is to get an idea about the, all the costs that we mentioned in terms of the total. So you have the absence of work, that's $325 million. You have the absence of workers, which incurs a cost of $154 million. And finally, the reservist recruitment, that cost is $130 million for a total of $609 million. Obviously, that's a lot of money, especially given the fact that you're looking at a war economy of some sorts. All right, let's bring in our guests and see what they think. David Hungerford rejoins us. He's an author and economist. David Hungerford, welcome back to Economic Divide. We're looking at Israel's economy and how it's bleeding in so many different ways, but one of the major ones is a shortage of workers. We're also looking at, to compound the crisis there, the restriction that it has placed on Palestinian workers from the West Bank. They're not allowed to work as part of their staff there. Tell us what you see Israel's economy and how it's going to move from this point on.
Exactly. I mean, and that's very badly disrupting Israel's economy. In terms of the West Bank, it's hurting things in terms of take-home pay. And that's certainly a very important aspect of any economy, but it's just going to mean all kinds of economic activity in Israel itself grinding to a halt. And this war, Israel cannot afford a long war. It needs a quick decision, and things aren't heading in that direction at all. And I think this is indicative of the overall trend.
Yeah, indeed. It doesn't look like this is going to end anytime soon. However, some may disagree, but Joe Quinn, editor at Sot.net, joins us. Let's see what he thinks. Joe Quinn, welcome back. I'm taking a look at Israel's economy in this question for you, and I'm not too sure what to ask you, but what's standing out week after week is the major problem with the shortage of workers. Aside from that, obviously the Palestinian restrictions since the work permits have been taken away has added fuel to the fire. But overall, Israel's economy is not doing well. And given the fact that this onslaught, genocidal war, is going to continue, how do you see Israel's economy and also the one in the West Bank, occupied West Bank?
I think they're willing to take a temporary hit to their economy in that respect, in terms of the Palestinians who are doing menial jobs in Israel, the jobs that Israelis didn't want to do. They're willing to suffer that, the consequence of that, for in the short term. I think they do have a plan to, as part of their genocidal campaign against the Gazans, they have a plan to deal definitively with their quote-unquote Palestinian problem. So Israel sees these shortage of workers that they've created, shortage of Palestinian workers, is only a temporary measure until they deal with it as they foresee it, and then afterwards they'll be able to restart. I don't think it'll work out that way for them, because generally speaking, most of what Israel plans to do doesn't work out very well for it, so we'll have to see. But I think it's only a temporary measure in their minds. But I think ultimately Israel economically, militarily, and in many other ways is not going to be the Israel that we've known until now for much longer.
Israel collects taxes on Palestinian imports and exports to both the West Bank and Gaza. It transfers the revenue after taking a 3% commission to the Palestinian Authority. But frequently, it uses it to exert pressure on the Palestinian leadership. The PA has been left without enough funds to pay public employees. An estimated 900,000 people in the occupied West Bank are in need of humanitarian assistance. Furthermore, around 95% of the donations made to the Palestinian Red Crescent are being directed to Gaza. That has left the West Bank in a desperate situation. Apart from that, Israeli settlements, military checkpoints, and roads designated for use by Israelis only already made traveling between areas of the West Bank difficult and time-consuming. Israeli authorities have further divided the West Bank into isolated areas over the past 3 months, disconnecting provinces and towns by installing dozens of new checkpoints. The tense atmosphere and closure in the occupied West Bank have affected almost all sectors of society. The UN estimated in 2019 that the Israeli occupation cost the Palestinian economy some $47.7 billion in fiscal revenues between the years 2000 and 2017.
Hello and welcome to the Quick Take section. I'm Matti Apossian. In this section, we'll cover two important sectors, the auto sector in Israel and the construction sector. In terms of the stats, the industry is only working at 30% capacity. Some 50% of construction sites are closed. The economic damage is $830 million a month. Keep in mind that the building and real estate sectors owe banks and non-banking institutions a little over $107 billion. Even if a small part of the debt is not repaid, it will be a huge hit for the whole economy. Many are not aware of the important role that the auto sector plays in Israel's economy and how much it contributes to Israel's GDP, and more importantly, the relation to the Yemeni army's targeting of Israeli-linked vessels. This was first revealed by CTEC under its title. The Israeli economy's greatest growth generator is also its biggest enemy, where it said that the biggest boost to Israel's economy in 2019 came from new car purchases. That year, economic data revealed that the gross domestic product increased at an annual rate of 4.1% after a growth rate of only 0.8% in the second quarter of the year. And this is where the Yemeni army targeting of Israeli-bound vessels comes in. The attacks have impacted the port of Eilat to the point that it is close to not functioning at all. The port of Eilat is the port that Israel received most, if not all, of its car imports. Any rerouting of vessels with cars impacts the final price tag of the cars, and that is not something that Israelis can afford. And this is what Israel is facing. Vehicle market collapses at 41.8% in November. Israeli vehicles market in November 2023 following the Hamas attack fell for the second month in a row. And that does it for this Quick Take section of the program.
Israel's cash-strapped and employee-strapped economy is suffering in such a way that it's hemorrhaging. It can't stimulate an economy that is part of one of the worst genocidal campaigns in history, a war that's not known when it's going to end, this onslaught that is ongoing daily. Then there are product shortages, in part due to Yemen's targeting of Israeli-linked vessels, and on and on and on. So what kind of economic future can there be, or recuperation, or whether there's actually even going to be one? That's anybody's guess. Can you take a guess as to how this is going to go? From Ikavi Tahwe and the entire team here at Economic Divide, it's goodbye until the next program.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is